Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. This morning, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Lynn Blewett with us again to go over the final version of health care reform that's been recently passed by the federal government. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Berglund and committee members. I'm Lynn Blewett from the University of Minnesota. My research center is called the State Health Access Data Assistance Center, SHADAC, and we do work with states around health reform, which we're now very busy. We actually have a bill, and I'm going to provide an overview of the key components of the bill. And just to note that a lot of the detail is coming out every day, which different memos, administrative letters in terms of implementation. So this is a high level. I know the departments are here. They can answer specific questions. But every day we learn something new that how this bill is going to be implemented. It has a very tight timeline for some things and other things. It's implementation in 2014. So I'm going to do six different components. We'll talk about the public program expansion, the private insurance market, high-risk pool, health insurance exchange, employer provisions, and delivery system and payment reform. So on the public program expansion and eligibility, this is the main access expansion of the bill. And the main components are the Medicaid expansion to 133% of the federal poverty level without regard to marital status, gender, dependence. It's a floor of Medicaid coverage across all people in the country. And then premium subsidy is the red component, which will go from 133% of poverty up to 400% of poverty, which is about $88,000 for a family of four. So those are the two components of the expansion. So it's Medicaid and then premium subsidies to higher income. So as of April 1, states can provide early coverage for people, for adults up to 133% of poverty through Medicaid. The states will have to keep their current match, and our matching rate is 50%. This is without the ARRA bump in FMAP, but that's what the law says, you to keep your current FMAP rate. And then you would phase into up to 100%, which is what the newly eligibles are, 100% match with the federal dollars in 2014. So if we started now, we could phase up to 100% in 2014. The other component is that states have to maintain their current Medicaid and SCHIP eligibility until the exchange is operational, which, again, 2014 is kind of the date there, and for kids up to 2019. And then in 2015, and the SCHIP matching rate goes up by 28 percentage points or 23 percentage points. So in for Minnesota, that'll be 88%. So that is for every SCHIP dollar we spend, 88% is funded by the federal government. And that is a 2015 date. And again, I'm not sure why it's 2015 and not 2014, but that's when the SCHIP match would increase. This is the law provides for federal coverage of the newly eligible up to 100%. So the federal government is going to pay for those newly eligible enrollees beginning in 2014. They'll pay 100% of the costs, and then the costs go down. So as the federal costs go down, then the state share would go up. So in 2017, they'll pay 95%. The state would pay 5%. So the idea is the federal Medicaid program is paying for the newly eligible, which are primarily those 0 to 133% that are not currently covered.
Ms. Blewett, do you know how they're going to be defining newly eligible?
Senator Berglund, my understanding, it's whoever is not currently covered right now. And my understanding, and I'd have to defer to Brian Osberg, the assistant commissioner at DHS, but my understanding is that states who have an adult-only program could come in under this newly eligible provision.
But the number of people that are enrolled in our program on any day varies. And so just because you're eligible for a program at the state level doesn't mean you're enrolled in a program at the state level. So yeah. Would it be the new enrollees, or would it be...
Senator Berglund, my understanding, it's newly eligible, so that's any expansion, not currently eligible but not enrolled.
So the requirement that you have coverage might bring more people into our programs than we have today, but those people that might have otherwise been eligible would not be covered under this new cost-sharing arrangement.
Senator Berglund, that is my understanding of how this is written.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Why don't you continue then?
This chart is a little bit complicated, but the intent is to show you that that there is a sliding scale for the subsidy. So the percentage points along the top are what percent of income you would pay. The faded blue shows percent of income. So at the lower income, you would pay 2% of your income toward a premium, which is between, you know, zero to probably $500 for a premium. And as your income goes up, you pay a greater share with a cap at 9.5%. So no one would ever pay more than 9.5% of their income towards the premium. This is based on an income for a family of four. So at 400% of poverty, this family, if they were at 400% of poverty, they'd pay $8,000 a year toward their health insurance premium. And I just put down as reference that the average annual family premium is about $13,000 or $14,000. So it's the subsidy would be about $5,000 for someone at 400% of poverty. So to think about what impact this might have on Minnesota, 5% of non-elderly population will be newly eligible for Medicaid. And as Senator Berglund brought up, there are about 60% of Minnesota's uninsured are estimated to be currently eligible. So they're not newly eligible. But the point is they may come in under this if there's outreach and people are coming in to get services or to sign up for programs, some will be newly eligible, some will already be eligible for existing public programs. And then in terms of how many people are between 133 and 400% of poverty to get the subsidy, that's estimated to be 1.4 million. That's some of those currently have employer-sponsored insurance, but that's the number of people in that category. So there's the two categories, as we saw here, which is the Medicaid expansion, and then the 1.4 million is the how many people would be eligible in the premium subsidy. So who's not covered by the subsidy programs? These are people with incomes above 400% of poverty, undocumented immigrants, and there's exemptions from the individual mandate, which include financial hardship, religious objections, American Indians, incarcerated individuals, and then people whose lowest cost plan option exceeds 8% of their income, and then people whose income is below the tax filing threshold. I'm going to move now into the private insurance market provisions. So the main provision here is the individual responsibility. It's the requirement that all individuals have purchased health insurance coverage. And again, I just went through the exemptions. There will be some people who are exempt from that policy. The other provision is young adults. Up to age 30, there'll be a catastrophic plan offered through the exchange. And then also people can be under, young adults can be on their parents' plan up to age 26. And the penalty for noncompliance is fairly minimum, but it's $325 per person in 2015 and then $695 in 2016. And that'll be applied to any uninsured adults who are not in these exemption categories. So effective 6 months after enactment, young adults may be covered as dependents up to age 26. Minnesota's current law goes through age 25, so it's an extension of our current law, and it applies to fully insured and the self-insured plans, so it's a market-wide mandate. There's pre-existing exclusion coverage for prohibited for children, that's 6 months after enactment. No lifetime limits on coverage. The annual limits are regulated. There's first dollar coverage for preventive services, so that's prevention is 100% covered, and then no dropping or rescission of private health insurance coverage. And I know the Department of Commerce is here and can clarify when they're testifying.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Blewett, for that first dollar coverage for preventive services, I've been trying to find out whether that's going to apply retroactively for policies already in existence, because I had heard from someone that it only applied for new policies going forward. Do you know if which is the case?
No, Senator Berglund, Senator Olson, I'm not sure. I would guess that it's not. It's only for newly established, but I guess I would defer to Commerce on that question, and if you want to wait or have them come up now.
As long as we've taken a break for questions, do you know if young adults stay on their parents' policies as dependents, if the tax penalty that families would experience has been removed?
Senator Berglund, are you referring to the tax penalty for?
Well, employers have interpreted it as a benefit that they are being given as if it were salary, and therefore they have given advisories to people when they are taking this option that they would have to report this as income for the purposes of taxes. It's had somewhat of a chilling effect on our law.
Senator Berglund, I'm not sure about that. I can try to find out the answer. That's an interesting twist to this.
Well, it's definitely been a problem in the past, and it has been a problem that only could be solved by the federal government. Right. So I hope when they did this, they solved it. All right, let's continue.
So issues related to premiums, there's a process of the state federal review of unreasonable premium increases, and there'll be grants given to state governments to set up this system to review and approve premium rates. Minnesota already does that, the individual and small group market. There are many states that have pretty much passive review, and states must report to HHS on the premium trends. The bill establishes minimum loss ratios of 85% for large groups, 80% for small groups, 75% for individual. So Minnesota's current law is 82% for small groups, 72% for individual. So we're pretty close to that, but that will have to be moved up. The Minnesota loss ratios in Minnesota are lower for carriers with a small share of the market, and so federal reform might have a bigger impact on them. And then, although the federal standard is higher than Minnesota, states may establish lower standards. And in recent years, Minnesota plan companies have reported loss ratios in excess of these rates. Rate regulation. So insurance companies establish their rates on a number of different factors, and those are now limited by this law. So you can't vary your rates based on gender or health status. And then it limits the rate variation. So that means you only for age from a 3-to-1 ratio, tobacco use 1-to-5 ratio. So that means any premium cannot be more than 5 times more than the lowest rate. Family composition and geographic area. And those are effective 2014. So those are how insurance companies rate their premiums.
Is that, Madam Chair? Is that five times for tobacco use or 1.5 times?
1.5, excuse me. Thank you, Senator Lurie. Thank you. Okay, so we move on to the high-risk pool provisions. So this is kind of an interesting development for Minnesota, who has one of the oldest and longest, largest risk pools in the nation, our Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. But the federal government is establishing a national temporary high-risk pool that will be available across the country. States have the option of establishing the high-risk pool at the state level. There's $5 billion appropriated. The states can contract with an existing risk pool or a carrier to establish this risk pool. It has its own rules and regulations separate from MSHA, separate from our state risk pool. The eligibility are for individuals with pre-existing conditions, and the probably the big issue is they have to be uninsured for 6 months. Our current risk pool does not have that waiting period. I should note that 34 states have risk pools. So there are many states that do not have a risk pool now and would take advantage of this federal temporary risk pool. So this is just comparing MSHA to the national pool. So right now our premiums in the high-risk pool are limited to 125% of what's sold in the individual market. And then the national pool will be based on a standard population, and it's not clear what that standard population will be and whether it'll be geographic or national. But again, the rating period, the rating will be based on age, and but again, limited. So older people cannot be more than four times younger people in this national risk pool. The maximum, they do set maximum out-of-pocket costs in the national pool. MSHA has a series of deductibles and co-payments, and so MSHA, you could pay up to $10,000 out-of-pocket, and the national pool will risk how much you pay for co-insurance and deductibles. And then the waiting period, again, MSHA does not have a waiting period, and the high-risk pool does have a waiting period. So the purpose of the temporary risk pool was to provide coverage for pre-existing conditions until the exchange is developed and prior to 2014 when insurance companies cannot deny coverage. So it's intended for this interim period. It's not meant to replace or supplement existing high-risk pools. So our high-risk pool, it's not intended to move all those people into the national pool. And given the six-month waiting period, we're not, you know, that it creates some dynamic in terms of if you establish a risk pool with no waiting period and you have one with waiting period, one's paid by the federal government, one's paid by losses, assessments on insurance carriers. There's just some interesting dynamics in how that pool is set up and how it operates alongside with MSHA. And the new pool might be cheaper for some people than the current MSHA based on how the rules are set up right now. Okay, on to the insurance exchange. So the insurance exchanges are basically a place at the state level where you could go and compare apples to apples on health insurance coverage. There's four different plans listed in the legislation, and I didn't put them all up here. They base, you know, typically on your deductible and coinsurance rates and out-of-pocket costs. So there's a silver, a gold, a bronze, and every health plan will fit into one of those categories, so you'll be able to compare and contrast the different plans that are offered in the private market. Exchanges are developed for the individual market and the small group market. States may pool those markets if they wish, but right now they're separate exchanges for the small business and the individual market. At least two national and multi-state plans will be offered in each exchange. So the exchange is a place to go to purchase health insurance coverage. It'll be a place where you can determine your credits for your premiums if you are eligible for a subsidy. Again, HHS will grant states to establish the exchanges, and there must be self-sustaining by 2015. The idea would they would be up and running in 2014 and self-sustaining by 2015, and there'll be startup seed money to establish those practices to the exchanges. There will be, again, required four benefit categories and based on actuarial value, and states may require additional benefits to be offered in addition to the basic benchmark plans that the federal government defines, and there'll be a catastrophic coverage plan for individuals under age 30.
So, Ms. Blewett, do you know when the grants will become available?
Senator Berglund, I think Commerce is probably waiting day to day. There's new issuance of you know, what's details about the program, and I'm not sure when those will be made available.
But I assume that a state could establish one of these exchanges before 2014.
Senator Berglund, absolutely. I think they want them up and running as soon as possible, and right.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Dr. Blewett, do you know whether the plans offered on this exchange could be a public type of plan as an option, or are they required to all be private plans? That's one question I have. And then the second question I had is, do you know of these couple that have to be multi-state or national plans, whether they would be subject to state consumer protection laws or within the jurisdiction of the state as far as those kinds of things go?
Senator Berglund, Senator Olson, I again would refer to Commerce, but I think there is still a role for state regulation, and if you're operating in the state of Minnesota, you would have to comply with state insurance regulation.
And then as far as a public option, would that be a possibility on the exchange, or is that precluded?
Senator Berglund, Senator Olson, it's not precluded that you could offer a public option through the exchange. Right now it's focused on the private market, but that's not to say that Minnesota Care or some other public program could be offered through the exchange.
All right, why don't you continue?
So the role of a state, it's probably one of the, well, it's one of the many things the state is responsible for doing, but within 1 year, grants will be given to states for the startup costs. The primary role of the exchange, they have to certify the plans that are going to be offered through the exchange, so certify them within one of these four categories. HHS will develop minimum benefit standards. Again, those are not developed yet, and benchmarks. And again, states may require benefits beyond the minimum, but they would have to, the federal government's only going to provide the subsidies based on those benchmark plans. They have to have a exchange that will facilitate comparison of those private plans, both for the individual and small employer groups, and then help enroll individuals in the public insurance option. So the idea is that you would be assessed your income, and you would either be eligible for the premium subsidies if your income is between 133 and 400, or you'd be eligible for the Medicaid program. And so the eligibility becomes very important to both the private and the public options. And then certify individuals who are exempt from the mandate. So if you're exempt from the mandate, you're not assessed a penalty. So that's another place where that would happen at the exchange. Okay. So on to some few of the select employer provisions in the bill. These are effective January 1, 2014. There's a free rider penalty, so that the idea is if the employers are not providing insurance coverage, that they are assessed a penalty. Right now it's $2,000 multiplied by the number of workers employed. There's exemptions for small business on this penalty, less than 50 workers. And then employers with greater than 200 employees must automatically enroll their employees in their insurance plan, and employees can opt out. So right now it's a voluntary take-up of an individual saying, yes, I want that plan. Right now employers will cover everybody, and they need to say, no, I'm opting out because I have coverage from my spouse or I have coverage from some other place. So this is a requirement that large employers automatically enroll all their employees in their plan if they offer a plan. There's premium subsidies for employers, for small employers under 25 whose average annual wages are below $440,000 a year, who provide employer-sponsored coverage. That's ESI, employer-sponsored and coverage. And again, these are detailed, which to think how this will be implemented is not quite clear to me yet, but they are very specific. It's up to 35% of the employer's premium contribution, and then up to 50% if the employer purchases insurance coverage through the exchange. So the idea is to provide tax credits to small employers and encourage them to offer coverage through the exchange.
Senator Berglund?
Yes, Senator Sharon.
Do you know, some of the questions I've been getting from small businesses in my area about this is whether or not what constitutes an employee? Is it an employee no matter how many hours they work? If they're very part-time, 10 hours, 20 hours, or full-time, is there language that says anything about what they're talking about here?
Senator Berglund, Senator Sharon, I'm not sure that that's been defined yet. So we can double-check and get back to you, but my understanding is that will be defined as the rules and regulations are developed.
Thank you.
Continue.
There's also something called the Employer Free Choice Voucher, which, again, it's fairly complex, but it basically requires employers that offer coverage to their employees to give them the option of taking that benefit as a voucher and purchasing the coverage through the exchange. So the idea is you take what the employers already offer. Instead of giving them health insurance, you give them a voucher worth the value of that health insurance, and you go to the exchange and say, I have this voucher and I want to purchase, you know, the bronze plan with this voucher. So the employer still pays for the benefit, but it's being provided in the exchange. Employers providing free choice vouchers will not be subject to penalties for employees that receive premium credits in the exchange. So this is, again, not clear how this is going to be implemented, but it looks like it's all going to happen at the exchange level.
So, Ms. Blewett, mm-hmm. could an employer offer this free choice voucher instead of offering insurance?
Senator Berglund.
Or is it the employee's choice?
Senator Berglund, my understanding it would be the employer's option.
So an employer could just offer this free choice voucher instead of offering insurance?
Senator Berglund, yes. That's my understanding.
And if that were the case, do you know how they would determine what would be a fair employer contribution?
Senator Berglund, I think there is some language around that in terms of what percent of the premium that would have to cover, and it would be based on the benchmark plans that have been established. And then there are some income requirements for who would be eligible. So the idea is to get that 133 to 400% of poverty. It's that group of individuals.
But we don't know what a fair employer contribution would be defined as yet.
No, I think it's, Senator Berglund, that the benchmark plans will have to be established, and they'll be based on an actuary value tied to those plans.
Okay.
I'm going to ask Julie Sonier, who's a recent addition to the University of Minnesota, to talk a little bit about delivery system reform. She was recently with the state of Minnesota working on these issues, and
welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Sonier, and I'm the Deputy Director at SHADEC at the university. I wanted to talk a little bit about the delivery system and payment reform provisions that are in the bill. Many of these provisions that are included in the national law bear a fair amount of similarity to the payment reform efforts that are currently being implemented here in Minnesota as a result of the law that we passed in 2008. For example, there's a fair number of initiatives around value-based purchasing, which really you can think of just as efforts to pay not just for the number of services that are provided, but also to incorporate payments that are based on quality. So, for example, there's a value index that will be added to Medicare physician payment methodology beginning in 2015. This will be based on a combined measure of quality and cost. Similar, you might recall that the provider peer grouping that's going on in Minnesota is also required to be based on a combined measure of quality and cost. Beginning in 2013, hospital payments will be based in part on quality, building on some pilot projects that have been going on in Medicare. There will also be planning for value-based purchasing of nursing facility and home health services. And then finally, there's reduced Medicare payments in the future to hospitals that have high rates of hospital-acquired conditions and high rates of readmissions. With regard to quality measurement and reporting, the law includes stronger incentives for participation in what is currently a voluntary physician quality reporting incentive program. Beginning in 2015, physicians that don't participate in that program will receive lower payment rates. There are provisions for comparative reports to physicians on resource use and quality. Again, there are some parallels here to the provider peer grouping efforts that are going on in Minnesota. One significant difference, however, is that these reports to physicians are confidential reports. They are not public reports. There's expanded public reporting of provider-specific quality. So, for example, there'll be more public reporting on the Medicare Compare website for hospital-acquired conditions and readmission rates. And then finally, there's substantial funding in the bill for development of new quality measures. The law includes several initiatives around care coordination. So, for example, there are bundled payment demonstration projects in Medicare and Medicaid that will begin in 2013. These are similar in some ways parallel to the work that's being done in Minnesota around baskets of care. Several of the baskets of care that are being implemented involve primarily ambulatory conditions. My understanding is that these bundled payment demonstrations really focus more heavily on inpatient hospitals. So you can think of those two initiatives as complementary. There'll be a 90% Medicaid match for 2 years for care coordination services provided in a healthcare home. And there will be an initiative to improve care coordination for Medicare and Medicaid dual eligibles by more effectively integrating the benefits across those two programs. With regard to improving system accountability, the law includes provisions for an accountable care organization demonstration projects. These would provide shared savings to provider organizations that meet quality standards. These are slated to begin in 2012. And the law also provides for a newly created Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation that will test innovative payment and service delivery models to improve quality and reduce costs. There's a long list in the law of the kinds of initiatives that this center could undertake. I've listed one of them on the slide because I think it is of particular interest to policymakers in Minnesota, given the conversations that have taken place in this state over the past few years around how do you create the critical mass to encourage reform on the part of the delivery system. So the law provides for demonstration projects that allow states to test and evaluate systems of all payer payment reform. Finally, there are several provisions in the law that relate to provider payments. So, for example, there will be a reduction in disproportionate share payments to hospitals beginning in 2014. This is intended to, as people become insured, there's an expectation that there will be less of a need for those payments, and that's what this is intended to accomplish. There will be an increase in Medicaid payment rates to the level of the Medicare payment rates for primary care. This will be fully paid for by the federal government in 2013 and 2014, and not after that. And then finally, there's an increase in Medicare physician payment rates in areas that have below average practice expense payment rates. This is expected to benefit Minnesota. And also an increase in payments to hospitals in counties that are currently in the bottom quartile of spending per person. This is another provision that is expected to benefit hospitals in Minnesota because they historically have been lower cost.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pratner Soln.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sonier, would you expand on that? You said that the increase in payments for Medicare and Medicaid would be paid in 2013 and 14. Who pays for it afterwards?
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, this is with regard to the Medicaid payment rates. It would be a decision that the state would need to make at that time, whether to continue paying those primary care rates higher. But the federal government, I assume that would just be the regular match as opposed to 100% match after 2014.
Okay.
Senator Lurie?
That 100% match would be for the increase, right. The increased portion of the Medicaid.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I think that is correct, but we can double check that.
Why don't you continue, Ms. Sonier?
So, as you can see, there are quite a few provisions in this bill. We've touched on a few of them. We believe that access and affordability will have a significant impact in Minnesota and elsewhere in the country. As Julie talked about, the incentives for delivery system and payment reform, Minnesota's in a very good position to take advantage of those and to be, you know, ready to do demonstration and pilots. We've already got a head start on many of those initiatives, which are very similar to what we've started in Minnesota. There are many details related to implementation that will need to be clarified by right now. The departments are getting directives from the federal government. There'll be rules and regulations defining many of these components, and those will be released in the Federal Register and allow for public comment. So a lot of this is in flux, but there's a significant amount of work in the short and long term, and just we want to offer our assistance to the departments and the legislature as you move ahead.
appreciate that. I do. I did have a question about now I've lost it, so let's see if somebody else has a question. Senator Sharon.
I've written some questions down, so I can't remember where in your presentation they came from, but one that I'll ask while Senator Berglund is looking. There are people that are exempted from participating in the requirement to have insurance. How is it anticipated that their health care needs will be met? How are their costs for their health care going to be covered?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, for many of them, Native Americans have the Indian Health Service. Correctional facilities have their health programs. Undocumented workers currently can receive services at community health centers. There are provisions to fund community health centers so that they would be, you know, how uninsured get care now, which is through free clinics, community health centers. And I'm not sure how many people that represents, but that's something that we're looking at.
Ms. Blewett, that usually doesn't include hospitalization.
Senator Berglund, yes, that's right. It's the community health centers are a primary health care benefit primarily, so there would be a lack of coverage for hospital care.
I found my question. It had to do with the funding for the development of new quality measures. Do we know how much money would be available and if any money would be available for initiatives that we might already be involved in so that we would be able to continue those in the future?
Madam Chair, I can't remember off the top of my head the amount of funding that's being provided, but it is significant. It's intended to... The quality measures are intended to be developed through multi-stakeholder processes, primarily at the national level. But I know that healthcare organizations in Minnesota already participate in those organizations to a significant degree.
So it wouldn't necessarily help Minnesota in terms of the quality initiatives that we initiated as a part of the 2008 healthcare reform. That were only funded for 4 years, I believe.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's literally money to fund the process of collaboration and figuring out what things should be measured for quality and what's the best way to measure them, as opposed to money to help states improve quality. It's more of a definitional kind of a process.
Let's see. Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know whether either the federal or state governments are planning any outreach around the state to help the public understand the same type of information that you've just presented to us, with perhaps even more detail once some of the questions are answered about implementation?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there are some outreach funding associated with both the exchange and the low-income subsidy, or the Medicaid expansion. But those, again, are part of the process of implementation. Those haven't been released or defined, but there is specific mention of outreach in those provisions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
What I guess I'm just wondering is a more immediate and broad type of public outreach. There seems to be so much confusion and so many questions about what's in the federal health care reform that I think it would be very helpful for there to be some type of an organized initiative to have public or town hall type meetings, just providing the information in a real factual way.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that's a great idea. I mean, we could, I know the university would be, well, my unit would be interested in participating, and we can talk to the departments about possibility to do some of those things. I think that's a great idea. I mean, it's a very complicated bill, and we're just starting to get our head around all the details, and we've just, this morning, just really scratched the surface. But some of the main provisions, I think, we can certainly, you know, develop some educational materials around. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Sharon.
You made reference to the fact that we have to make the exchange self-sustaining after a certain time period. That's up to the states to figure out how to sustain that, pay for this. It's another cost that we're going to have to be figuring out in our long-term planning process. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, that's my understanding, whether it would be an assessment on the insurers who participate in the exchange or some administrative fee, but that it is saying they have to be self-sustaining.
But, Senator Sharon, at the same time, it should reduce somewhat marketing efforts that are going on currently that are built into the price of products. So
that's true. May I ask another question, Senator Berglund?
Yes, Senator
I'm
Sharon.
Not even sure. I wrote this down, but maybe you can figure out what I'm asking when I ask this. When you were talking about the loss ratio difference between states under that segment, it came into my mind, I wondered how, because there's a lot of discussion out there about allowing products to be sold between states, and Minnesota has some clearly defined expectations about what is allowed to be sold in the state, even though it can come from another state. How does the loss ratio difference between states impact how Minnesota might utilize different products from other states? Or how does it impact us in terms of the products that we will allow on an exchange?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think the federal law will establish a floor of loss ratio across the country. So there should be a floor in terms of loss ratios. The state still will regulate whatever product is sold within their state. And so if they'll have to meet that minimum loss ratio standard. If the states have a higher loss ratio, it would be where the product is sold would be regulation of that product.
Senator Berglund, but
Sharon?
But there is discussion, not that we're moving forward on that, but when I listen to discussion about why not just let people buy any product from any place without any boundaries, just open the market and let people do that. Mm-hmm. How does this impact the difference of products that are coming from other states versus what we would have right now in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator,
does that add to the cheapness of a product?
I think I'll defer that to Commerce when they come up to testify. I think they could probably answer it better than I'm trying to.
Are there other questions? Dr. Blewett, will you be able to stay in case there are questions later?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Happy to stay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't we move on then? We have our new state health economist with us this morning, Ms. Todd Mamlov. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is April Todd Malmlev. I'm the new state health economist and director of the Health Economics Program. In fact, today is my third day on the job. But the three of us, we would like to thank you for having us here today to present to the committee. In the spirit of cooperation and coordination that all of the state agencies will need to work together going forward on the implementation of this bill, we will be presenting a joint presentation to you today. The presentation is an overview of the law in general and specifically more focus on those provisions that take effect in the early years. And again, as Ms. Blewett emphasized in her presentation as well, even though there's a lot of detail that is in this bill, there is still a lot of work needed to be done at the federal level by HHS, IRS, and DOL and other agencies to come up with regulations and rules in terms of how this bill will be implemented. So we may not have all of the answers for you today, but they will be forthcoming in the next few months. So just to start off, give you a background just in general on the overview of the overall cost, coverage, and financing components of this bill. Over the next 10 years, the bill is projected to cost roughly $1 trillion, $938 billion. Roughly 32 million of the 54 estimated million uninsured will be covered over those 10 years. A bulk of them, 24 million of them, will be covered in the exchange through subsidies. 16 million will be covered through the Medicaid expansions. And there will be a loss of roughly 8 million lives from the individual and group market.
And are these national numbers?
These are national numbers from
right.
the CBO.
So, but in Minnesota, there would be some people that would be covered through the exchange that otherwise would have had public insurance through one of our state public programs.
Yes, potentially.
Right.
Financing for the exchange, roughly half of it comes from changes in spending in Medicare and Medicaid, and the other half from new tax provisions. In terms of Medicare and Medicaid, one of the biggest sources of funding is reductions in Medicare fee-for-service payments. It's roughly $200 billion in reductions in payments. There are also changes in the structure of the Medicare Advantage program, some of them structured to assist states like Minnesota and Midwestern states in terms of how the benchmark rates are set for those plans. For example, high-cost rates, the benchmark rates will be set at 95% of fee-for-service. But for low-cost states such as Minnesota and other Midwestern states, the benchmark rate is set at 115% of fee-for-service rates. So this is one way in which the federal government is trying to level out some of the payment disparity that has been occurring between the states. There are other provisions as well. Part D pharmaceutical discounts coming from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, Medicaid drug rebates that Mr. Osberg will be discussing in more depth later, reductions in Medicare and Medicaid DSH payments that will be going to hospitals. Those reductions go down as the uninsured decrease. And a small amount is figured in for payment reform. There is a small amount figured in here primarily because most of the payment reform that is included in the bill for Medicaid and Medicare are in the format of pilot and demonstration projects. The other half of the financing for the bill comes from new tax provisions. One is a new Medicare tax. There's roughly $200 billion that comes from that tax. It's an additional 0.9% on the Medicare FICA tax for individuals making over $200,000 and families over $250,000. And a new 3.8% tax on those same individuals for unearned income. There are also new insurer and pharmaceutical assessments. An important thing to note is that the insurer annual assessments that start in 2014 are only assessed on fully insured fully insured plans. There's also a new medical device tax. The Cadillac tax that many of you have probably heard of on high-cost plans starts in 2018. There's also a variety of FSA and HSA tax changes. The tax deductibility of medical expenses for individuals increases from 7.5% to 10%, and there is a new tanning bed tax as well. I'll hand it over to Mr. Munson-Ragala for the insurance market reforms.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Manny Munson-Ragala. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. One of the first things that's immediately taking place is a process being set up by HHS and the states to do premium rate review. One of the observations I've had after looking at this process is despite the daunting amount of work that Minnesota is going to be facing, we're remarkably ahead of the curve relative to our peer states. We're getting lots of calls from other states about how do you do rate review? How do you do medical loss ratios? How do you do some of the things that we take for granted in Minnesota? So I keep that in mind as we go through this process. We're probably going to be engaged in and have been engaged in providing a significant amount of input to the NAIC and to our fellow states on how you get this stuff done. For example, with respect to the premium rate review, we're helping HHS draft the questions to send to the states on what kind of elements you need in a rate review process. So that conversation is going on right now. The next thing I want to talk about is the high-risk pool. There is roughly $5 billion. We have to decide by the end of this month whether or not we will apply for our allocated share of that $5 billion. HHS will tell us how much of that $5 billion they believe comes to Minnesota. And they've signaled it will probably be based on an allocation formula that looks like the CHIP allocation formula, but they haven't made that conclusion. The big question for us is how much money and what potential open-ended liability does the contract come with? If we choose not to contract for the money, then HHS will run a national risk pool for this population. We're hearing some conflicting opinion that, no, we're not going to be on the hook if the money runs out. We're being told that, for example, you don't have to continue to enroll people in the eligible population if the money runs out. But I guess we want to make sure that that's the case before we make any commitments to HHS to enter into this process. Okay. There's a conference call next week to talk more about that application process. I expect it will be a lot of questions from a lot of states along these lines. We're going to meet with MCHA to discuss whether or not, after we get some answers to those questions, there continues to be an appetite or is an appetite to have them take on this new role. Do we have to do a different entity, or do we have to make a conclusion or recommendation that, you know, there are just too many questions here, HHS might need to do this for us?
Well, Assistant Commissioner, wouldn't there be a potential for reducing the MSHA assessment if we could receive this money?
Madam Chair, that's one of the questions we have. I don't think so. The problem is the way the structure is set up, the folks eligible for this program have to have been uninsured for 6 months. So if they were in MCHA already, they would have to go bare for 6 months before they could get
right. But couldn't there be newly? I mean, there's always new people coming into MCHA. So couldn't this pool of money be used for new people that would be coming into MCHA that might prefer this benefit over the current benefit? I mean, the current benefit in MCHA, I can tell you, is not that great.
Madam Chair, that's a good question, and actually that's one of the things that we're going to explore with HHS. One of the questions that Jay Engoff, who's a former insurance commissioner from Missouri, been retained by Kathleen Sebelius to help with healthcare reform, met with insurance commissioners a couple of weeks ago. One of the questions he was asked by the Ohio commissioner was, could you use the high-risk pool money to set up a reinsurance layer for your existing high-risk pool? So to get to your point, that could be a way to help defer some of the deficits that are running in MSHA now. He didn't shoot it down, but he wanted more information on where Ohio was going with this proposal. So I think we're going to learn a lot in the next couple of weeks about what may or may not be doable with respect to using our existing high-risk pool.
Well, we'd appreciate it when you get more information if you would pass that along to us.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. We talked about some of the immediate insurance market reforms for plan years, and this gets to Senator Olson's question. For plan years starting 2010, in 6 months from now, there's going to be no lifetime benefit limits. We should get annual benefit limits. Dependent coverage to age 26, we're at 25 right now. Coverage of preventive services, and those are going to be defined pursuant to specific metrics as to what goes into preventive services without cost sharing. No pre-ex for kids under 19. I understand that was a question coming from you, Senator, as to how the plans plan on implementing it and how we plan on enforcing that provision.
Right. I wanted to know how. I mean, there's like some 3,000 children in MSHA now. I wanted to know how you were going to be notifying those families that they would have the opportunity to get covered in the private market.
Oh, okay. Senator, that's a little different question than the one I was prepared to answer, but we will be working on, part of our interagency group is some outreach relative to communicating with the general public. I think one of the things we're thinking about doing is a series of roadshows to explain what's in the bill, what's the short-term changes that people can expect. But we're still working on sort of our communication process. We'll probably be partnering with our friends from SHADEC and other resources. There is money, for example, for an ombudsman program in the federal legislation that would deal with both consumer inquiries, consumer complaints, and outreach. It's not clear how that grant process is going to work. It's also not clear, because it has to be, quote, a independent office, what that means. The way I would put it is, how independent does independent have to be? Can it be a separate office in an existing agency, or do you have to create a new agency? So we're looking for more guidance with respect to that item.
Well, if you do have public meetings, we hope you would keep us informed of those also.
Esley, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Munson-Regala. And kind of the same question I had before, and kind of incorporating also Senator Sharon's question. In terms of looking at how comprehensive the consumer protection language is that's built into the federal health care reform, I have kind of a two-part question. Do all of these requirements also impact ERISA self-insurance types of policies? That's the first part. And then the second part is, any of these programs that are offered on the exchange or offered through any type of somehow, if we were to allow people to purchase insurance from other states, are they still going to be subject to the requirements that we have in our state law with regard to lots of things, like what types of coverage they have to offer, what a percentage of money can be spent toward administrative costs, et cetera, et cetera. And so, because that is always the concern. People think it's a good idea to be able to go out and purchase insurance from wherever you would like because of the idea that somehow competition is going to drive down costs. But in fact, we could just simply have all of these insurance companies incorporated in our state today, reincorporating in another state where they don't have these kinds of requirements, and then offering inferior products back to people in Minnesota, which is the concern I think many of us have. So how will that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, this is jumping into my presentation a little bit, but that's okay. We can wing it. The structure for defining the essential benefits plan, the process will go as follows. The Department of Labor will conduct a survey of employer plans, ERISA plans today, to determine based on that subset of the marketplace, what's a common benefit design. And if you want to start with sort of an assumption of what that might look like, you start with the 17 federal mandates that ERISA plans have to comply with. My guess is it'll look, this essential benefit plans, and this is just my guess, and I wouldn't want to put money on it, but it's going to look not quite like our 65 mandate design set. So that's the first thing we have to understand. We can insist that plans sold in the exchange, these multi-state plans, the plans that the Office of Personnel Management, the exchange plans, have a Minnesota add-on, if you want to call it that. The question for the members is going to be the cost of that add-on for folks who are subsidized, eligible for subsidies. We are on the hook then to pay that differential. So whatever that, you know, let's say it's an additional 15, 20 benefits that are not in the standard plan, we will have to decide how we compensate the folks who have to buy a plan, are getting subsidies. We either compensate them directly or we pay the plan that they pick. So that's the way that structure would work. With respect to the consumer protections relative to network accuracy, prompt payment, sort of market conduct behavior, the states do have a role and continue to have a role in enforcing those measures. The challenge will be in conforming potentially some of our consumer standards with the new federal standard. And some of that is still to be drafted. There are a lot of rulemaking, a lot of regulations being done right now. You talked about, for example, medical loss ratios. We're familiar with the concept of using medical loss ratios as a way of triggering rebates. But that HHS is in the process of drafting that standard now. It will not be surprising to you, I suspect, that when they come up with new standards, they'll look awfully familiar. And I say that because our folks, our actuaries, are being engaged in the process of helping draft things like the annual rate application that is going to be the standard being used. So the good news for folks doing business in Minnesota insurers is if they have to do business anyplace else, they'll be used to this process because it's going to look, I suspect, alike like the way we do things in Minnesota with respect to rate review. You asked a lot of questions also about ERISA and non-ERISA. The answer is maybe. There are some provisions in the federal law that apply to all products, whether it is a self-insured or fully insured. There are some that only apply to fully insured products. We're in the process right now of identifying that that list. We've set up a temporary website on our Commerce homepage, which is one of the resources we've listed. We'll likely go with probably something in the Department of Health's website eventually to house a lot of these FAQs, spreadsheets, comparisons. One of the big tasks our folks are going through right now, for example, is looking at, and we have one on the high-risk pool that we'll be posting later today, on how the federal law compares to existing Minnesota law.
But, and Senator Olson, the previous slide did say that those provisions apply to the fully insured and self-insured markets.
Right. Those.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to continue?
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the questions that I understood the committee was interested in is what enforcement authority or Commerce may have with respect to particularly the pre-X for kids. One of the things we can share with you is we received letters from both the National Association of Health Insurance Plans and from the local Association of Health Insurance Plans telling us that they will, in fact, comply with the regulations that HHS issues, assuming any time now, with respect to enforcement of the pre-X condition. We also can tell you we've shared draft language with Senator Scheid and Representative Atkins in the House. It's modeled on language you folks implemented back when HIPAA was being debated, and it's a one-paragraph sentence that basically says Commerce and Health may enforce regulations that HHS promulgates. I think that my suspicion is Senator Scheid may be talking to you about, or she, we haven't talked to her about whether she plans on carrying it, but we've suggested that that might be something she can add to our market assurance technical bill.
Where is that bill in the process?
She's thinking about, I think, hearing it on Tuesday of next week on the floor. No rescissions except for cases of fraud and misrepresentation. And we are meeting with the health insurers on April 15th to discuss short-term implementation. We're trying to minimize, we're trying to make the process of compliance as efficient and as easy as possible because they will have some communication issues with their existing members today. Though we're going to talk about later the option for folks to keep their existing coverage, and that's going to pose some interesting challenges for us. Starting next year, we talked about the new medical loss ratio. We're likely to need to get some finality to that process this fall. The NAIC is charged with coming up the recommendations, giving them to HHS. You're probably familiar that Secretary Sebelius is the former governor of Kansas, but you might not be familiar. She also happened to be the former insurance commissioner of Kansas.
Oh, no, I know her well.
Oh, very good. And that, like I said, we are working with the NAIC on the process of promulgating or defining those standards. In 2014, the small group definition will be 1 to 100 unless we act to reduce the size to 50. There will be no more premium variation based on health status anymore. Here are the rating variations, 1 to 5 to 1 for Sandra Lowry for tobacco, age 3 to 1. We're at 4 to 1 right now. The geography, and this is the regional variation, to get the Senator's question about, there'll be a standard bogey for medical loss ratio, but the numbers that go into that will flow from the regions as defined. And family composition. There are wellness discounts allowed under HIPAA for group plans. They're going to increase from 20 to 30%. HHS may be looking at going to 50. They're looking at a 10-state demonstration project to look about extending that to the individual marketplace. Guaranteed issue and renewal is going to be required for individual and small plans during an open enrollment period. No more pre-ex conditions prohibited for fully insured and self-funded plans. And no more annual limits for all fully insured and self-funded plans. Next slide, efforts to increase competition. $6 billion in loans and grants for the establishment of co-ops, not already in existence, to offer coverage to individuals and small groups through straight exchanges. Secondly, the multi-state plans, the Office of Personal Management coming up with these two private plans to offer individual and small group plans in each state exchange. There's also language on states forming compacts to allow the purchase of individual plans across state lines, though those plans need to comply with the essential benefit design. Lastly, the exchanges. I'm going to quickly talk about the one thing you want to think about when you're talking about exchanges. They don't have to be state only. They can be regional. And there, in fact, we had an informal conversation at the NAIC in the Midwestern zone, and the Midwestern zone of insurance commissioners is from Indiana to North Dakota and down to Nebraska in the south. There was some interest that there may be enough commonalities in the Midwestern states with respect to wellness measures and approaches to healthcare outcomes that maybe there's some value in looking at a regional exchange. The other thought was a regional exchange creates a much larger marketplace, affords more competition. Just a possibility. I'm just suggesting when you think about what kind of an exchange you want to set up, you leave yourselves the flexibility to look at a regional approach. One last about the exchange. HHS is going to assess our progress towards creating one by 2013. So even though they're effective 2014, there's sort of an interim scorecard to see where we are in the process. If they conclude we're not making progress, then they might do an exchange for us.
So I'll be taking it on from here. As Mr. Munson-Ragal was explaining, the exchanges take effect in 2014, but there is a provision in the law which is a precursor to the exchange that starts in 2010. Actually, effective July of 2010, HHS with states, and there's no definition on what with states means, is to establish an internet portal to help consumers identify coverage options. This information to be provided in this internet portal is to be provided for individual and group plans, Medicaid, CHIP, and high-risk pools. By June of 2010, so two to three months from now, HHS is to develop the format for the comparison of these options. What will be included is MLR, eligibility, availability, premium rates, and cost sharing. So think, for example, the Medicare Compare website for Medicare Advantage plans. They're envisioning something similar to that for all plan options for consumers. In 2014 is when the exchanges become effective. The standards are to be developed by HHS as soon as is practical. And those standards include standards for plan certification, marketing, network adequacy, plan rating for cost and quality, standards for navigators. And what navigators include are brokers in addition to potentially consumer advocates, chambers of commerce, those types of things that can get grants and funding from the exchanges to help people enroll and inform them of the options that are in the exchange. And also we'll... HHS will also be working on establishing provisions for risk sharing, and this includes things regarding risk corridors, which is similar to Part D. That is a temporary for a temporary period of time from 2014 to 2016, reinsurance program as well, which is temporary during this period of time, and a permanent risk adjustment system that would apply to plans as well inside and outside the exchange. That HHS, in consultation with NAIC, will be developing options from which states can choose or can propose their own methods. States are also, HHS will also be coming up with standards for states to implement and establish an electronic interchange to determine eligibility and enrollment for subsidies and for Medicaid. And this interchange includes collaboration with between the exchange and DHS and Department of Revenue to figure out eligibility for subsidies and for Medicaid. Funding for the exchange is to be available within 1 year of enactment. HHS is to award $2 billion for the creation of these exchanges, so on average, roughly $40 million per state.
By enactment, you mean enactment of the federal law?
With it, yes.
Or enactment at the state level of an exchange?
Within 1 year of enactment of the federal law, the funds become available. Okay. And as a...
Senator Prettner-Solon?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those same lines, I've been wondering, there must be state laws that we have to enact in order to come into compliance. Does that are there some that still have to be done this year, or can they wait till next year?
I believe the exchange can wait till next year in terms of establishing it through state law. The things that are happening right now are within 6 months, as I understand it, dependents will be allowed to stay on their parents' policies, and that will be true regardless of whether you're fully insured or not. I don't think we need to change any laws to affect that. The other is the Medicaid buy-in, and we'll be getting to that with Director Osberg shortly.
Okay.
Why don't you continue then?
And I know that there was a question earlier regarding the financing of the exchange. The funds, the $40 million on average that states would get, may be used to fund the exchange up until 2015. And in 2015, states may establish user fees, but there are also various other options the state has to fund the program. The structure of the exchange, there are various options for a state to consider in terms of the structure of the exchange. They may set up a separate or a combined exchange for their individual and small group markets. As Mr. Munson-Regala was explaining, there's also the options for a regional exchange and also for subsidiary exchanges within a state. So a state may have more than one exchange, for example, one in the Northwest, one in the Southwest, one in the central part of the state. That is also an option as well. And the exchanges may be operated by a governmental or a nonprofit or quasi-public-private organization, but it is specified that it may not be operated by a Medicaid agency or by an insurer.
Or by a what?
Or by an insurer, a carrier. Eligibility for the exchange. The people that are eligible for the exchange are individuals that are not eligible for affordable employer-based coverage. That means individuals whose premium would be more than 8% of their income. Those individuals would be eligible for the exchange. In addition to those individuals, small groups are also eligible to participate in the exchange, and states may allow larger groups above 100 or 50, whatever a state defines as small group. They may allow those larger groups to participate starting in 2017. There are some interesting things to consider regarding the exchange within the exchange and the outside market. The benefit rules Ms. Blewett was describing earlier, as well as the rating rules, the risk pooling, and the risk sharing, they apply inside and outside the exchange to all individual and small group plans. However, subsidies are only available to plans within the exchange. Another interesting component related to exchanges that particularly impacts Minnesota is related to Section 125 plans. In the 2008 health reform law, we have a Section 125 mandate for employers. Within the bill, it prohibits cafeteria plans to be used by those individuals, for example, whose employer does not contribute to coverage but provides a Section 125 plan for them to get a pre-tax benefit. It prohibits that for plans inside the exchange. It still appears to allow that for plans outside of the exchange. Benefit plans, I'm not going to be going into this in depth, as you've already heard this from Ms. Blewett, but I did want to discuss the last option that is on here for benefit plans, and that is what is deemed a basic health plan. The basic health plan provision, this is a provision that was added by Senator Cantwell from Washington, which is modeled off of the basic health plan in that state. And what this allows is it allows states to use 95% of the subsidy funds that would have been allocated to the state for the exchange to use those for individuals between 133% of poverty and 200% of poverty, those people without access to employer-based coverage, to be put into a basic health plan that is negotiated between the state and private plans to provide coverage for these individuals. Some important things to consider with this plan is that the benefit requirements need to match at least the minimum benefit requirements under the minimum established essential benefits plan. And individuals that would, if a state chose this route, individuals would only be allowed to enroll in this basic health plan between those income eligibility guidelines. So they would not have a choice between a basic health plan and a plan within the exchange. They could only be in this basic health plan. Another feature of the basic health plan is that there is the ability to have interstate compact basic health plans. So you could have a basic health plan that served, for example, the states of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, for example. In terms of coverage requirements, I know that Ms. Blewett also covered this in great detail, so I will not go over this much. But I did want to mention the procedures for the state waiver. The state waiver process becomes available in 2017. However, within 6 months of enactment, HHS is going to be developing the guidelines for what a state would need to do if they would like to seek a waiver from the requirements of the exchange related to the bill, related to the exchange, benefit plans, subsidies, and coverage requirements. To date, the extent of the guidelines in the bill states that a state waiver must provide coverage for at least as comprehensive and affordable coverage. They must cover a comparable number of uninsured and not increase federal funding. There will be more guidelines coming out within the next 6 months that may influence what it is that we may be tracking or evaluating over this period of time to determine if in 2017 there are things that we would like to modify, particularly to Minnesota. Next, I'll be talking about some of the payment reform and the quality and wellness components of the bill. Again, I'm not going to be going into this in great detail, as Ms. Blewett and Ms. Stonier already covered many of these. But as mentioned, there are many Medicare and Medicaid demonstration projects and pilots related to care coordination and payment reform. And these will be evaluated through the new CMS Innovation Center, which is started in 2011, to test these pilots and demonstrations. And as also mentioned, this provides the opportunity for states to also work with CMS on some new potential payment reform and care coordination options as well. In addition to those pilots and demonstration projects, there are also other things related to payment reform in the bill, one of which is the Payment Advisory Board is created, a new entity. This is not MedPAC. It's a new entity established to report on system-wide healthcare cost, access, and quality, and to recommend ways to reduce national healthcare expenditure growth. Particularly related to Medicare, if Medicare costs are unstable, the recommendations made by this group would become effective unless Congress acts within a specific period of time. In addition to this, there are also new what's deemed data reimbursement centers. This is created in 2010, and they may be developed by academic or nonprofit institutions, and they would collect and analyze medical reimbursement data for insurers. Participation by insurers is voluntary, but somewhat of the intention of these data centers is to collect information from insurers to help them determine what the aggregate costs and spending are throughout the country to help determine out-of-network payment rates. And then lastly, there's also required under the exchange are quality improvement plans from plans participating in the exchange. There are no guidelines yet as to what these improvement plans must include, but in general, plans to be certified in the exchange must supply information on what they are doing to improve health outcomes through new payment incentive structures.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Todd Mullenlove. Do we have a CMS director yet?
There's been one appointed. I am unsure if it has taken effect yet.
Madam Chair, Senator Scherr, I'm Brian Osberg, State Medicaid Director. There's one that's been nominated, Dr. Don Berwick, who is the president and CEO of the IHI in Boston. And so he needs to be confirmed at this point. But we do have, there's leadership at the Medicaid level and there's leadership at the Medicare level, but it's not yet been confirmed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Todd Melville.
In the area of payment reform and care coordination, in a number of the examples, it's indicated that there's five states or eight states. Were those states identified within the bill, or are states, is it a competitive process, and can you highlight for us those projects and pilots that Minnesota will be participating in?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Lynch. The states are not specified in the language. There are some, and I will have to look and see which ones those are. There are some that are competitive, some that are not on the pilot and demonstration projects. At this point, I would have to defer to Mr. Osberg in terms of some potential work on the Medicaid side in terms of some of the interest in some of those demonstration projects.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, we're very interested, especially in this global capitation or payment arrangement for five states, up to five states can participate. We hope they don't limit it to five states, but this would be whereby we could work with safety net hospitals, the new coordinated care delivery systems under the new JMC bill, for example, whereby we could do a global payment with those facilities. And so that's an early option or early, it's an available demonstration for 2010. So we intend to look into that very seriously. There's other aspects of the reform legislation that we're looking into that have earlier effects.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to kind of follow that, I'm wondering, it sounds to me like there are many, many different areas where there are possibilities to acquire some federal funding if certain actions are taken. And since this is such a broad bill and there are so many of those different kinds of opportunities, I'm jotted down a few. It sounds like there are opportunities to set up cooperative plans within an exchange, opportunities for an ombudsman program, opportunities for pilot and demonstration projects, and so forth and so on. I'm just wondering whether, kind of following up on the question that was asked earlier, whether we shouldn't be looking quickly at whether it's necessary to act legislatively in order to take advantage of some of those opportunities and to know specifically what the timelines are, especially where there are competitive processes for limited pots of money, and or if we don't act, is the administration going to just decide which ones of these opportunities to pursue, or do you need legislative guidance in order to make those kinds of decisions? And then the third question I have is whether it's from Commerce or whether it's from the university, could someone put together for us some kind of a timeline that would show us what the deadlines are for each of these opportunities, regardless of whether you act or we act or someone acts, you know, where we need to be planning for meeting or deciding not to pursue each of these opportunities?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we have put together a multi-agency work group to do that very thing so that we can advise the legislature on what opportunities, requirements, and options you have in front of you. And we're in the process of making that available. I would suggest that you go to the National Governors Association website, which has a list, or we can send it to you, the link, a list of all the available grants, near-term and longer-term, to states and to other organizations regarding this. And we intend to make it known to the legislature in the next couple of weeks, or as soon as possible, once we have clarity around some of these issues, what exactly opportunities, options, and requirements you do have, and where you have to have some legislation in order to exercise that, or where you have to comply. So I'll touch on a little bit on the Medicaid piece, for example. But that is clearly something we wanted to do with you. Not only do that now, but also during the next 6 to 8 months, for the next administration and the next legislature, so they understand all the opportunities, options, and requirements as well. This is a short-term and a long-term exercise.
And Senator Olson, I don't expect that we'll have another hearing on this subject during the remainder of this legislative session, but I do expect that the Healthcare Access Commission will be very busy working on what we would need to do for the next legislative session. Are you finished with?
Senator Berglund, I just want to make sure I understand. I think this is, would be very helpful to me, what we're talking about, and I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, which is what would be helpful for me is all the opportunities you're talking about graft out in terms of deadlines and then a definition of the action that has to be taken and whose responsibility it is. Is it the department's through rulemaking, or is there a legislative action? That would be very helpful for me is as you figure that out to have that graft out for me to understand where we need to be participating and acting.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we will certainly do that. We'll lay that out.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just one question to you. Related to, I mean, this is a huge reform piece, and as we move forward, there are many of us on this committee that aren't on the Healthcare Access Commission.
Right, but you're always invited to come.
Well, I think it would be a good opportunity to have us meet as a full committee on these things as we move forward.
I just don't think we're going to have time. We're going to have to be putting our omnibus bill together pretty soon, and after that, we're not going to be probably having committee hearings. So I just think practically we're not going to be able to, but we could have full committee meeting during the interim to look at this again. But I think there's going to be a lot of actual hands-on work that's needed in regard to making recommendations to the legislature for action next session. And I think that'll be the work of the Healthcare Access Commission. Some of you won't be so available either, I'm sure.
Well, Madam Chair, Madam Chair, I would just say to kind of reiterate, since this committee is charged with ultimately making those decisions, it's really hard when you're not involved in the hands-on work. And I realize there are other things happening, but I think many of us really want to be using the committee process as we do in other areas of our budget and within the state to really be a part of those discussions so that when we come forward to vote, it becomes the work of this committee.
Will be. It'll go, everything will go through the regular legislative process next year. Did you finish your presentation?
No, we still have a few.
Why don't you continue then?
Pertaining to the quality strategy, by January of 2011, HHS is to develop a national quality strategy. Starting in 2010, a federal interagency work group is established to coordinate and streamline quality activities and to align public and private sector initiatives as well. HHS is going to identify gaps in quality measurement and collect and aggregate data from a variety of sources to publicly report on quality measures. Of particular interest is that by 2012, HHS has been instructed to report on 10 quality measures for acute and chronic care and 10 measures for primary and preventive care. At this point, there is no requirement for the states. However, it may in the future have some impact on the types of quality measures that we are reporting if we want to streamline and be in coordination with what the federal government is doing.
So I guess one of the areas that I've had some concern about as to whether this will hold us back or dilute the efforts that we already have in terms of quality measurement. I think we're quite a bit ahead of where most other parts of the country are, and I'm certain that we're ahead of where the federal government would be with this effort.
Yes, Madam Chair. Given that there are no responsibilities for states in this and that this is a national effort, I would not think that this would dilute our efforts in any way. Going forward, we would definitely be well ahead of the curve of the federal government, and I would think that they would look to Minnesota in terms of some of their development of their measures. Mm-hmm. However, if some of their measures that they develop going forward are in some way slightly different in the definition from ours, it may be something in the future for us to consider maybe modifying some of the measures that we are collecting and reporting on.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rose.
Madam Chair, and nothing is going to be preempted by the federal reform won't preempt anything that we have done in Minnesota in this area.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it in terms of the quality measures, it does not appear so.
Okay.
In terms of prevention, HHS is also to establish its first report in 2010 on a national prevention strategy as well. There is a new $13 billion trust fund established for prevention and public health programs. Grants to states will start in 2010. There are a variety of different things that could be funded, but for example, specifically mentioned in the legislation is a competitive grant to states to reduce the incidence of chronic disease, particularly for those between the ages of 55 and 64, to reduce future Medicaid spending. Other things of interest regarding prevention, as has been mentioned before, within 6 months of enactment, all plans must cover preventive care without cost sharing. And cost sharing is also a limited for services under Medicare, and states can get an additional FMAP increase for covering preventive services without cost sharing in 2011. The last slide that I will cover is on wellness and workforce, and then I'm handed over to Mr. Osberg for some thoughts on Medicaid. In terms of wellness,
Senator Berglund, before we move to the next slide, this says grants to states start in 2010. So this is one of these deadline issues and my question is, grants means there's lots of different options. How do we make the decision about which one of those to pursue? Is there activity that we need to be engaged in as a legislature to help establish what our priorities are about that so that we can move forward and get action going and getting competitive in relationship to these grants? We have the State Health Improvement Program, which is a program that is about prevention and trying to interfere with those factors that do create chronic disease. And if there's some money out there that helps us fund that in the long term, I think we ought to look at that and maybe other options that are out there. So can you tell me where we're at on that and what we need to be doing or what I can do to help make certain that these prevention dollars are captured in Minnesota?
Yes, Manager, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon. This is somewhat of a timing issue. There will be grants for the funding, but the guidelines and the rules around what they are and when the grants will be coming out are not available yet. And so it's not something that we can concretely say this is what we need to do. I know the timing is not probably ideal. When we know more information, we will be communicating that.
And Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, certainly we don't need authority, legislative authority, to do this, but your direction and your input on this would be very helpful. You're welcome to do that, but these kind of grants, we don't necessarily need legislative authority to pursue.
Senator Berglund, I understand that, and I just want the opportunity. I think this committee would like to have an opportunity to have input, and we can't without the information. So if that's available, I certainly would like to have that made available to us.
Related to wellness, HHS is to establish a five-year $200 million grant for wellness programs for employers not currently offering worksite wellness programs. That starts in 2010. Also, as mentioned earlier by Mr. Munson-Ragala, there will also be wellness discounts under HIPAA are increased for group plans from 20 to 30%, and HHS may increase to 50%. And there will also be a 10-state demonstration to apply these discounts in addition to the new rating rules to the individual market. There will also be incentives under Medicaid and grants to states incentives under Medicare and grants to states for Medicaid to establish financial incentive programs to incent healthy behavior among enrollees. And lastly, effective 2010, there's also a national workforce strategy that is to be developed, and there will also be grants to states, competitive grants, to carry out a comprehensive workforce development strategy as well.
And that might also be another way to help us carry forward with our CHIP grants, because, as I understand, part of the grants are for implementing changes in the workplace or working with employers to improve health outcomes.
Yes, but again, the rules and regulations are still unclear at this point.
Right, but it's an opportunity to keep in mind.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosett.
My biggest fear on this and in the prevention part is that they're going to look at Minnesota and say, well, you've already put money into prevention. And I'm very concerned that the dollars are going to go to the other states that haven't spent any.
Well, we need to remember the money we put in ends at the end of this biennium.
Hopefully the feds will look at that too. Yeah.
And hopefully we will have some results to demonstrate that we would be worthy of continued funding that other states might not have.
That's right.
Well, Madam Chair, members, the next slide relates to Medicaid reform. And as you heard, most of the reform around Medicaid is going to take place in 2014. However, there is an early option available to states, and CMS is in the process of giving states guidance as to how we can go about doing that. We're trying to determine whether or not the early options can be based on current Medicaid criteria and rules or future Medicaid criteria and rules. For example, the asset test. In 2014, the asset test will not be an asset test for these populations, but today there is. as you know, we have two programs for adults without kids in Minnesota, all state funds, one through Minnesota Care Program and then one through General Assistance Medical Care Program, which, of course, is going through significant changes at this point. So we've sat down with CMS and said, this is what we have today in terms of adults without kids coverage, because, Senator, or Madam Chair, you asked earlier who's eligible for newly eligible. It's anybody under 65. However, we cover parents up to 275% today. We cover kids up to 275%. So the early option really applies only to adults without children in this case. But newly eligible does mean not just adults without kids. Some states don't have coverage up to 133% of federal poverty, and they have to now provide coverage beginning 2014 to parents up to that standard. So the early option we're talking about here is putting adults without kids into a Medicaid arrangement. So we've said, please consider the possibility of us allowing to convert one of our Adults Without Children programs into Medicaid. They said, well, that may be problematic. We'll get back to you. We also said, well, we also have parents covered through medical assistance and through Minnesota Care. And we had a waiver for some time to cover parents in Minnesota Care in up to 275% of poverty. Please give some thought to maybe just putting adults without kids in one of those categories. We've been told that we'll get guidance, not just us, but all states will get guidance tomorrow. It may slip, but hopefully it'll be tomorrow from CMS as to exactly under what terms and conditions we can exercise this option. And as was said earlier by Dr. Blewett, the early option is 50% federal match. However, there's an outside chance that they may say that the current enhanced FMAP may be available as long as the current enhanced FMAP is in play. We don't think that's likely, but that is something that is still being talked about at CMS. But right now, as you'll hear from Mr. Hoffman later, we're assuming 50% match, federal match for this early option.
Mr. Osberg, when they give advice, are they going to be flexible? Every state that has programs for adults without children have different kinds of programs. Are they going to be flexible in terms of how they will approach this on a state-by-state basis, or is it going to be kind of a one-size-fits-all?
Madam Chair, that's not clear. I sense that since they already given waivers, to your point, to some states to cover adults
exactly.
without kids, and the state of Washington is seeking a waiver. That's how they're going to go about this. Now, waivers take some time to do this. And
exactly.
I know that the legislature is interested in seeing what can be done early in
exactly.
this process. But so we don't know that for sure. My guess is, yes, there will be some flexibility around that. However, when we talked to them last week, they were adamant that you cannot have an asset test in the early option. Now, whether or not that's going to change by tomorrow, I don't know. Now, that would cause difficulties if we had no asset test for adults without kids, but an asset test for people with disabilities and for parents.
Pregnant right? women.
And pregnant women. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So we would have we laid all that out in front of them, and they now understand. Of course, it helps a lot. One of our former Medicaid directors, Mary Kennedy, is in the CMS office, so she's helping them inform them of exactly how our programs do work and how this may. They're wanting to be flexible and they want to do the right thing, but it's not clear to what extent they feel they can do that. So we'll find out more. In fact, I'm meeting with them in person on Tuesday to do that very thing. Is to okay now for Minnesota. What exactly can we look at in terms, now with this guidance, what can we look at in terms of some flexibility?
So I have said this to Mr. Osberg already, but I'll say it in public as well, and it just seems to me that for our Minnesota care population without children, having to go through the process of applying for another waiver for them when we already have a waiver for parents who are in that program, I mean, why would we want to have a waiver that would have different terms and conditions for the adults without children in the program than we do for the parents that are in Medicaid in the program. So my hope is that we could just simply apply a state plan amendment that would allow us to apply those conditions that we already have through the waiver for parents to people without children in Minnesota care.
And Madam Chair, one thing we're suggesting is maybe we can transition from where we are today to 2014 over time. We're laying that out to CMS as a kind
right,
of a phase-in.
That is another option because right. Obviously by 2014 we have to do things differently, but to expect us to be able to do that today, especially with the financial constraints the states are facing, I think is perhaps not realistic.
One of the good news, the fact that we cover adults without kids with all state money puts us in the category of newly eligible states, meaning in 2014 we'll have 100% federal match for a couple of years, then it goes down to 90% over time, whereas the so-called expansion states, which have waivers for adults without kids, start at 75 and go up to 90% over time.
Well, now, at least we aren't going to get punished again.
Yes, it's happened to us in the past. That's right. And we'll lay all that out for you soon in terms of the over time, what the long-term effect is financially to this expansion program. But it appears that we won't be able to convert the current program into this option, but we'll see again in the next couple of days. We'll know more about this. In terms of some of the financing issues, one of the challenges that we're going to have is that there'll be an extended maintenance of effort, as we've talked about in the past, is that with the enhanced federal match that we received last year in the federal stimulus package, we had a maintenance of effort provision for no changes in eligibility standards, methods, or procedures. And that goes until, now it goes until 2014, and the maintenance of effort goes until 2019 for kids. And we'll point out to you when you put together your budget bill where we have to buy back some previous cuts. If you remember last year, legislature enacted a provision whereby we changed the criteria for level of care for determining eligibility for long-term care services. That was going to go into effect once this MOE was going to be lifted, which last year we thought it was going to be at the end of 2010. Well, that
Mr. Osberg, are there things that you need to identify that go beyond what the governor had already identified in subtracting from the FMAP money that he projected to balance the budget?
Madam Chair, no, we have already identified the ones that for this biennium. Now we just have to say that it's going to now affect the tails. That's probably the new piece that we're going to have to add to your assessment. Is that this maintenance of effort provision is now going to affect not only this biennium or this calendar year, it's also now going to affect.
Wouldn't that show up in the next forecast?
Madam Chair, I would ask Mr. Hoffman to address that issue when he maybe comes up hereafter.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it isn't like we don't have enough to worry about right now, about having to worry about what we right. hardly even know for sure we have to do.
The sole exception we have to the maintenance of effort is that for parents above 133, which we do cover in Minnesota care, we can there's not maintenance of effort to provision affecting that population. If we can demonstrate there's a deficit, of course, and unfortunately, we can demonstrate that there is a deficit going forward. But that's the only exception to the maintenance of effort is that population. And then the other is no increase in local portion of non-federal share. In other words, we can't ask counties to pick up part of the non-federal share during this period of time either. Loss of pharmacy rebates, this is a bit concerning to us. This will probably be reflected in the next forecast, and that is the federal government, in part to pay for this legislation, is going to capture some of the rebates that we have from drug companies through our programs. We have about $100 million a year in rebates from drug companies, and we're not sure exactly what the impact of this is going to be yet, but I'm afraid it's going to be in excess of $10 million potentially. But again, this will not be reflected until the next forecast. Increased federal financing was already mentioned that the 23-point increase in financing for CHIP is up to 88%. It starts in 2013, not 2015, 2013. However, we only have about $48 million of CHIP money. Most of our kids are covered through regular Medicaid. So it's not as though we have now 88% federal match for all kids. We have 88% federal match for some of our children who are in Minnesota care above the 133% FPG line. And then 100% match for primary care increases, that's already talked about. And the 90% federal match for healthcare home.
Strasburg, if I can just go back to that last point. Right. I don't exactly understand how this enhanced CHIP funding for children in Minnesota care above 133% will work if these children are supposed to be getting insured through an exchange by 2014.
Madam Chair, the children will not be getting coverage through the exchange unless we make that decision. They'll be covered. That's the only, frankly, the way that's now structured is that we have two programs. We have the Medicaid program up to 133, and we'd have the exchange for people above 133, except for children. We are required to have our program in place covering kids up to 275 up to 2019. So we would have, we potentially still have a Minnesota Care program for children. Now, we could enroll them through the exchange, but making sure that they have the Medicaid benefit set.
I see.
That's the option that we're going to present back, those options are present back to the new, next fall, to the new legislature and new administration about what options we may have in terms of preserving Minnesota care, as opposed not only, because as Ms. Todd Malmuth mentioned, there's also an option that states have in terms of taking some of the federal subsidy around the exchange and doing something different with this basic health plan.
Right. I'm assuming also there would be an opportunity for the state to buy wraparound packages for certain income levels of people within the exchange if they chose to do that.
Madam Chair.
For example, you know, it's great that children will have access to private coverage, but, for example, our TEFRA kids have needed to get some services through the state because insurance doesn't cover all of the things that they might need. So we might want to consider doing something to, for certain income levels, to enhance the insurance they might be able to get through an exchange.
And Madam Chair, you're right. The challenge would be how we finance that, of course, going forward.
Madam Chair.
Right. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Can we enroll children up to 275% into the Medicaid program?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, right now we have Medicaid up to 150% for children. I don't think we would change that. Again, it's always an option to do that, because 133 is the floor, not necessarily the ceiling. So it's a possibility. But right now, we're as we kind of forecast this out, we're assuming that Medicaid coverage for children would stay at 150% of poverty.
Well, we have a lot of options to look at, I think, is the point here.
And Madam Chair, the last point here is, as already mentioned, the 90% federal match. This is for just the care coordination fees, not for the services provided through a health care home. And this is for, actually, this is more immediate. This is available for 2 years once we have a state plan amendment that's approved. We have an amendment that's already been approved for our primary care coordination program for the higher, more complex clients that we have, where we get $45 to $72 per month. That's what we'll pay for that care. Our healthcare home state plan amendment is now in front of CMS, so we'll be shortly, and where we'll pay on average $31 per month per client for our healthcare home service. But that's where we get the 90% match, not for services provided through the healthcare home. So it's about a $1 to $3 million opportunity that the legislature then could book.
We are.
Yeah. And then, Madam Chair, the next slide, the new mandates and opportunities. As of 2011, requires the coverage of freestanding birthing centers. I know that's in front of the legislature today. You can do that. We can do that before 2011, but it's a requirement as of July 2011. It also strengthens the hospice coverage for children, so there's less room, flexibility in terms of how we define that that coverage. And that's more immediate, and we're going to let you know by next week whether or not we have to have legislative authority or compliance.
When next week? By next week, days matter.
Madam Chair, I don't. I'll get back to you today about when next week.
Thank you.
And then, as already been mentioned, we have opportunities to participate in pediatric accountable care organizations. Accountable care organizations, of course, are provider organizations that would do delivery and payment reform on a global payment basis. And as already mentioned, we have the opportunity to now work with Medicare for the first time to develop our payment reform models. This is going to be very important. If we're ever going to make a significant change in payment reform in the state, we have to have Medicare at the table. This allows for Medicaid for the first time to do some creative things around payment reform, like bundle payments based on an episode, for example, for knee replacement, or global payments. And also Medicare is going to be doing the same thing. So it's important that we coordinate that work. And we tend to go after a grant, advanced primary care grant, that will allow us to pursue integration of Medicare and Medicaid around some of these reform efforts. Then the last point here is strengthens program integrity efforts to prevent and detect fraud and abuse, both in Medicaid and the private insurance market level. There's strong emphasis on that in the new legislation. Madam Chair, the last graph is that the long-term care side of this. So there's one provision that provides for the community first choice option, which is an increase, a 6% increase in federal match for this. But we're not sure how this interplays with our current consumer-directed services program. So our continuing care administration is looking at this to determine what opportunity beyond what we're already doing. We have a strong program already for home and community-based services in Minnesota. And so what this is intending to do is get those other states who have not done that an incentive to do so. But we're not sure whether or not we'll be eligible for this additional 6% federal match, because we've already done something like this. But we'll let people know that soon. And the last point is develops the CLASS Act, which is really a public option for long-term care insurance. And it really does. It's a voluntary program, but it will operate through employers. People have to opt out. But by and large, premiums will be deducted from your paycheck through your employer to participate in this long-term care insurance program. And you would have to opt out of that. I'm not sure what the premium level is going to be. I'm not sure if they even know yet as well. And that's 2012 effective date for this program. With that, Madam Chair, that finishes our presentation. We are willing and wanting to work closely with the legislature during the interim here to understand, again, the opportunities, requirements, and options available to you. And administration will soon be discussing that, how we can best do that with you very soon, I believe.
Thank you. I'm wondering about the 1% FMAP for covering preventative services. I'm assuming that's in our Medicaid program.
I'm not sure if that is, but that's only if we don't waive or don't have copays now. We don't have copays for preventive services. So this is a 1% match that goes to the states who do have copays for preventive services, which, frankly, I didn't even know you could do. So And so that's our understanding.
Don't we have co-pays for office visits?
No, this is for, no, we do not, Madam Chair. Remember, we eliminated that. We only have co-pays now for pharmacy and for non-emergency ER use, which we're going to bring down to $3 because of a federal compliance issue. But no, we do not have.
So we won't be eligible to get this?
That's our initial reading on this, is that we will not be eligible because we don't have a co-pay today on preventive services.
What about, Madam Chair?
Can we implement a co-pay to get it?
There we go. Real fast.
You don't know that either, I suppose.
Madam Chair, I don't think so, no.
Madam Chair?
One other question in regard to potential wraparound or public option within the exchange. Is that still going to be allowed if you do a multi-state exchange?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I think that's one of the conversations we're going to have with HHS on the regulations they're going to be setting up for the exchange.
All right, well, if you could get back to us when you know the answer to that question.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Prettner-Solin?
I don't know if this will work, Madam Chair, but we do still have insurance plans that pay for preventive care. Can that be used as a match?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, no, I'm afraid okay. not.
I think it's only in our Medicaid program.
Okay.
That's correct.
Other questions, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Osberg, on your first bullet there, the community first choice option, is there additional information that's available today on that in terms of what the incentives are and what's available and how we might tie into that?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we'll get that to you. There's not much yet as to how that's going to work exactly, but we'll get whatever we have to you.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Well, I guess a lot of questions will get answered in the future as we go along, and I think we look forward to understanding this better as you do. Thank you very much for your presentation today.
Thank you.
And I guess with that, the meeting is adjourned. Oh. What? Oh, George. Sorry. Sorry. Probably the most important part, and I almost forgot to do it.
I have to stand up to the members unless they already have been.
Is it this?
Pagination may be a little different. How many?
We have something that looks like this. It says medical assistance.
Do I have a copy of what you have, so I talk about the same pages?
Yes, Ryan, can you get Mr. Hoffman a copy? And I think before you start that, you know, it'd be good to acknowledge all of the things we just heard that we don't know. So this is like a guesstimate, George, based on what you think rather than what we know, right?
Well, Madam Chair, this is, I think, a closer... the guesstimate part is how much expansion of enrollment it would bring us over the building blocks of existing program pieces. And so this is pieced together. Unfortunately, when these things go into Excel from Lotus, it kind of messes up all the margins. And so this isn't as clean as... I almost feel like I should hand out my copy.
That would be fine if you want to do
easier.
That.
It's because the justification is better, and it's easier to see how the whole thing works. I think this will take about 15 minutes, Madam Chair. Do I have 15 minutes?
That's okay. What we
have.
So go.
These estimates are pieced together out of the building blocks of existing program elements. So if we start on the second page and look at the first and the largest building block is the estimated costs for the historic GAMC population that would be picked up by this program. And the estimated cost here is built on what we what we would forecast the old GAMC program would cost if it continued, plus some adjustments that would have to be made to it as a piece of a Medicaid program. And those adjustments are a significant increase in the capitation rates. The department has made efforts over the years to hold down the GAMC capitation rates, which are high anyway compared to what we pay for a lot of other populations. But we have held down those rates, and CMS would not certify the level of rates that we have held them down to. And so I've made an adjustment here for a 20% increase in those rates.
You know, I have a lot of questions about what is
would pay in the GAMC program.
I have a lot of questions about what is an actuarially sound rate, because I know other states have lower rates than we do in their Medicaid managed care programs. So I think that's probably an ongoing discussion as we look at this issue.
Yes.
Needs to take
and
place.
And I
guess I also don't believe that CMS has ever challenged a state based on actuarial soundness. So that's another thought to keep in mind.
Okay, second building block is the transitional Minnesota care managed care population. This has been funded under Minnesota care, and here the main adjustment is that I've allowed for 11% higher capitation costs for the elimination of the inpatient hospital cap and inpatient hospital copayment. Third building block is the adults without kids in Minnesota care up to the 75% of FPG income level. That income level is used in this analysis because that's what's in the Senate bill. The Senate bill says that we would opt for the early expansion up to 75% of the federal poverty level.
Right, we have some amendments we're going to be asking you to cost out to that bill. So,
okay, we're set up to do this up to whatever, up to 133 of poverty
or lower,
or anything in between. Those are the three existing program building blocks. Now, if we go back to page one, the additional piece added to the cost would be people enrollment we would pick up who we assume would be uninsured under the existing program structure, and these are actually many, not all of them, but some of them are the same people staying in the program longer or starting in the program earlier. The reasons we would pick up more people than existing programs are that it would be free. We charge a premium in Minnesota care, and the Minnesota care population is a part of what's coming into this. Also, having a premium process always knocks people off of the program, and that happens quite a bit under Minnesota care. This would be a better benefit than we have in Minnesota care. Not any different, or at least I'm assuming the same benefit set as we have in the GAMC program. It would allow retro coverage up to 3 months. That's part of what you have in a Medicaid program. So that would be additional coverage. And it would have a higher asset limit or maybe none. In this analysis, I've assumed the $3,000 asset limit that is in the Senate bill. As Mr. Osberg said, we're not sure at this point whether we can have an asset limit. The effect of the asset limit on these numbers is that the expansion enrollment, which is shown on the first page, is about 20% lower because of the $3,000 asset limit. That's the extent of the difference. Without any asset limit, we would add back that additional enrollment that would give you a somewhat higher cost for this expansion. So adding up those pieces from pages 1 and 2, there is a total of the projected medical assistance enrollment and costs at the top of page 3. And then we identify offsets or savings to the Minnesota Care Program. And there is no offset for the transitional Minnesota Care Managed Care Group because the recent GAMC legislation eliminated that piece, so we're not recognizing any savings here for offsetting that, because the total savings for elimination of that were taken in conjunction with the GAMC legislation. The offset for other Minnesota Care adults without kids, you'll know, you can look and compare the enrollment reduction shown here, like the minus 7,015 average monthly enrollees. That's the same as the enrollment effect on the bottom of page 2, on the lower part of page 2, added to the medical assistance option. The dollar savings are not the same because of the assumptions that were made that the cost would be higher in the medical assistance option. So the savings in Minnesota Care shown here is less by the amount of those adjustments. The summary of this all the summary of the fiscal effects is on page 4, and significant additional elements come into the summary. First, we have the bottom line of the state share of the medical assistance costs. This comes from page 3. Then we show a savings for a transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund in 12 and 13. This may not, what I have on here about transfers from the Healthcare Access Fund to the savings to the general fund, the cost to healthcare access, we were just having discussions with MMB about whether the effect of these transfers would properly show up on the fiscal note or not. So that may not be in the fiscal note, but it's a shift of money from one fund to the other fund. And then we show an offset of the GAMC funding, which we assumed was available after the recent GAMC legislation. And so that is taken as available. If Minnesota did the early expansion, we wouldn't need to continue the modified GAMC program. And these are the amounts of funding for that program we assume would be available to offset the cost of the federal expansion in the general fund. In Minnesota Care, it's a little more complicated. There's the savings from the bottom line on page 3, and then the line avert remaining JAMC cost shift. I'll explain what that's about. After the JAMC veto, we forecasted very substantial additional costs to the Minnesota Care program, which we expected to be caused by the movement of people who would otherwise be on the GAMC program over to Minnesota Care. In the fiscal note on the recent GAMC legislation, we recognize substantial Minnesota Care savings coming out of those forecasted costs. That's what I'm talking about as the GAMC cost shift, the shift of what would otherwise be GAMC costs to the Minnesota Care program. The row in this summary is taking out or is recognizing the savings of the rest of those forecasted costs to the Minnesota Care program. It's the rest of those forecasted costs that were not taken as savings in the fiscal note on the GAMC legislation.
So, George, do you know how many people are in Minnesota Care that are at or below 25% of poverty?
I'm not sure I know from memory, but we have that information readily available. Of the people under 75 of poverty, a majority of them are under 25. So
within Minnesota Care or within GAMC?
In both, Madam Chair. I don't think the proportions are exactly the same, but it's a majority in both cases. Our data indicates a lot of people with zero income, or when you look at the people under 75 of poverty, a whole lot of them have either little or no income, according to our data.
Okay. Are there other questions? It's nice for George to plot this out for y'all so you can understand what I'm dealing with.
Are we finished, Madam Chair? Would you like me to?
Well, I think we would like a few minutes for questions, so why don't we see if there are any?
Okay.
Are there any questions for George about this fiscal estimate that he's made so far?
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
So the cost to the state then is $451 million for the biennium, is that correct?
The net cost across both funds, $450 million. An important part of that is that even after the GAMC legislation, we're still looking at a substantial forecasted deficit in the healthcare access fund. And on the principle that we can't save money we don't have, I've offset the value of the deficit in this summary against the healthcare access savings. So the shift of people to a Medicaid option would substantially reduce our obligations in the Minnesota Care program. But because of the deficit, I think the right way to view it is a pretty big part of those obligations is unfunded because there isn't enough money prospectively in the healthcare access fund to pay for it. We get a benefit, but part of the benefit, at least in this summary, I've treated as going to fill the healthcare access deficit. And considering that, or netting out the healthcare access deficit, the bottom line cost across both funds in the 12 and 13 biennium would be $451 million.
And of course, Mr. Hoffman knows, and members might also be aware of the fact that there might be other ways to solve the deficit short of using whatever federal funds we could get. So, you know, I don't want to dwell on this for too long a period of time here because, as I said, this isn't the whole picture.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Hoffman, if I'm understanding correctly what you said, that part of that $450 million cost is really, we've taken some of the savings that we would be getting to fill back into the deficit we're going to have in Minnesota Care. If that's what I'm understanding correctly, then it would seem to me that really to get a truer picture of the cost of this, we ought to be able to know what that number would be and subtract it from that $450 million, because otherwise we're going to have to come up with that money somewhere else, I would think.
Well, Senator Olson, the deal is you don't enroll people in Medicaid for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Federal government isn't going to accept a plan that would do that. So if we're enrolling anybody in an early option for Medicaid, we have to figure out how we're paying for it, not just this year, but how we're paying for it in the next biennium as well. And I think that's the point that Mr. Hoffman is making.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Sol.
Wasn't there a provision, though, that states such as Minnesota would get a grant for covering that period of time? I thought there was. Mm-hmm.
The grant is the federal match, but in order to get the match, you have to come up with a state share.
So we have to decide then whether it's less expensive for us to take advantage of that or not, whether there's a savings to us.
Well, obviously, for the people that we would enroll and for the providers who take care of them, it would be good if we can enroll them in Medicaid. But we have to come up with a state match at 50%. And we have to change some rules of our programs that add cost to our programs. And that's kind of where the difficulty lies.
Okay.
That's what the struggle is.
But Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I was understanding Mr. Hoffman to say that there is going to be a deficit in Minnesota Care, and I think that's an ongoing problem. It's not just a one-year problem. That some of these people would now go into that program, and I thought he was saying in terms of how he's looking at these numbers that somehow he was not counting the amount of money that would have to go to backfill the Minnesota Care program.
No, I think what Mr. Hoffman is saying is that if we are going to move forward with enrolling some people in Minnesota Care into an MA option, we need to figure out how we're going to solve the Minnesota Care deficit in the next biennium rather than waiting until the next biennium to do that.
Madam Chair, I might. Another way of looking at it is I didn't want to identify savings in Minnesota Care of dollars that we don't have available. And so I offset in this summary, offset the value of the Minnesota Care deficit after the JMC bill. If there were no Minnesota Care deficit, there would be a bottom line savings instead of a $451 million cost in this analysis.
And Madam Chair, that's what I thought he said, and I guess that's why the point I was making is that we're going to have to deal with that Minnesota Care deficit one way or another, I would think. And so it seems to me we should count that, because if this is a way of addressing that problem and there's savings there, then that to me is a more appropriate way to be analyzing this or looking at this than disregarding the impact that it has on the Minnesota Care Program, because that's an issue we're going to have to address, I would think.
Well, Senator Olson, you can't enroll people in Medicaid just out of one program. You have to allow people to be enrolled in Medicaid out of both GMC and Minnesota Care at whatever level you're going to do it at.
Right. Madam Chair, I understand that, but I guess what I'm saying, though, is that the overall net dollar figure that we're looking at in terms of analyzing this, I would think should not be discounted because we have a deficit in Minnesota Care that's being projected that we're somehow not counting or taking into consideration because we don't have that money booked.
Senator Olson, Mr. Hoffman cannot assume that we're going to solve that deficit unless we show him how we're going to do it. And so I think the way he's portraying it is appropriate. Are there other questions? Now, thank you very much. And now the meeting is adjourned. Sure.